There are, by some estimates, 5.4 million adults with autism in the United States. Maybe that's 5.4 million plus you. It's Depression Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. People with autism are just as susceptible as anyone else to things like depression, anxiety, trauma, stress, all manner of mental health problems that are happening all over the place. And autistic people have added factors like difficulty socializing or hyperacusis, an increased sensitivity to sound. Just functioning in a world that wasn't built for them could be a huge challenge. Lauren Ober is a journalist and veteran podcast maker. Not long ago, Lauren was adding up a lot of different aspects from her past and present, Lauren's in her 40s, and began to wonder if she might be somewhere on the autism spectrum. Spoiler here, she tested and she was. The experience is chronicled in Lauren's recent podcast, The Loudest Girl in the World. In a little bit, I'll talk with Finn Grattan, a therapist who specializes in autistic and neurodiverse clients and is autistic themselves. They'll talk about why they don't use the word disorder to describe autism and why having an official diagnosis might not be so crucial. But first, Lauren Ober. Lauren Ober, welcome to Depression Mode.
Oh my gosh, thanks for inviting me.
And we go way back to two pivotal places. One, we worked at the same place doing really great shows that aren't at that place anymore.
It's true. Yeah.
And I once wrote something about a radio show where they talked about what was happening on podcasts. It was all about how what you could be listening to instead of this radio show. And I made fun of that concept, and you were hosting that show.
It's true. You know, you just have to throw stuff against the wall and see what sticks. And
yeah,
podcasts on the radio.
Podcasts on the radio, exactly.
And now podcasts don't even need radio because there are so many of them.
Now there's probably a podcast about radio shows just to make us come full circle.
Well, and if there isn't, there should be.
There ought to be, yes. Some sort of old-timey thing. When were you diagnosed with autism?
Ooh, we're just diving right in.
We're diving right in.
In November 2020, pandemic times, I'd been thinking about it for a while, and then the pandemic gave it an urgent quality.
How so?
I think because everything sort of fell to pieces for everybody, but for me, I was like, oh yeah, I can keep it together. And then it's like, oh wait, you don't have your routine, and you don't have a place to go, and you're stuck in your house with no structure. And I do well with structure. And I started, you know, really lingering on some particular issues in therapy, and they became more and more pressing. And then, you know, I started thinking about those more, plus lack of routine, and how I felt totally overwhelmed by things like going to the grocery store and shopping for 2 weeks of groceries or something. You know, in the early days of the pandemic, they're like, well, this thing will blow over. And so just go like get a bunch of, you know, canned soups for 2 weeks. And I was like, I don't know how to shop for 2 weeks. and for some reason that really floored me. And I remember the fight that I had with my partner. She was like, just go shop for a couple weeks. I was like, how do you even do that? You know?
It's not how it works.
And so then I thought, ooh, this doesn't feel typical. So, yeah.
So, and then at that point, you went and got yourself tested and then worried a lot about the results for a while.
Yeah, I did. I mean, a lot of people have asked, like, why would you even, who cares? Like, you're in your 40s. Like, what does it matter? You've lived your life. You're doing just fine. And it's like, yeah, but I've lived my life with a lot of negative words that have been associated with me, I think. And I think having an answer for those, or at least an explanation, felt important to me. And you know, it's very hard to get evaluated if you are an autistic adult, or if you think you are. It's a industry geared towards children, and it is an industry geared towards men. And so if you are not a man or a child, it's really hard to find the correct people to help you. But I did, and I got a diagnosis, and then, yeah, and now I'm autistic, apparently.
Or you've always been autistic.
Or I've always been, yeah. Or I just got it from the vaccine, the COVID vaccine.
Right, yeah, yeah. That's because science has proven that that's where autism comes from.
Yeah, totally, totally. I'm like, give me all the vaccines. I want so much autism.
That is not where autism comes from. Please don't send your lawyers to us.
No, it does not. It does not, no matter what certain parent groups say.
And you mentioned issues that you had been working on in therapy. How far back do you go with therapy?
I was in therapy in fits and starts as a older teenager. I think I was having problems when I was, you know, like a senior in high school and early days of college. And I would sort of like go to a therapist, but not really know what to do. And, you know, I really had a breakdown situation in college, and I went to a psychiatrist, and he gave me some type of medicine that didn't do anything, but was extremely expensive. And then I really didn't monkey with therapy until probably about 15 years ago. And then I've solidly been in therapy, I think, for the last 15 years with a number of therapists.
What were you originally, back in your teens and in your college years, what were you trying to address? What was the issue?
Well, probably the issue I was trying to address was my sexuality, because I am a dirty homosexual, but not dirty. I'm just like a really boring gay. But I think in high school, I was having these sort of feelings like, oh, am I gay? I don't know. And then I was very anxious about it. And, you know, this was at a time when this was in the 90s. Like, people, it wasn't like every other celebrity is like gay or bi or queer baiting or whatever they are doing now. So it felt really scary. But also I was just anxious. I was a generally anxious kid, and there, you know, there was a lot of stuff going on, obviously. I mean, I was an undiagnosed autistic kid. So, you know, you put two and two together there. Like, it was not easy going for me.
So it was like anxiety kind of thing, a depression kind of thing,
no,
or just
angst? It wasn't depression.
Angst?
It was anxiety. I mean, look, I had friends in high school. I was a very good athlete. I went on to play sports in college. Like, I had, you know, I was not isolated. I had community. I would not say I was sort of actively suffering in any kind of way, but I was also extremely anxious. I think this sort of prospect of college, but also this sort of notion of my sexuality sort of descending on me, really sent me into a bad space. Like, I just couldn't imagine being like a gay adult. But of course, I didn't tell the therapist that, you know, because it seemed to be a terrifying thing. I mean, it wasn't until, you know, I was probably 24 or 25 that I actually came out properly. So it was a while. But I think the first thing that pushed me into therapy was that sort of looming college anxiety, and then also, you know, sexuality stuff. But I didn't stay long. I like went, you know, a couple of times, and I was like, goodbye, this is not for me.
You say that you've been going much more consistently, solidly for the last 15 years or so?
Yeah, for
what,
sure.
What changed that made you a regular customer?
You know, I think what brought me back to therapy was I had a longtime partner who was really suffering from depression and anxiety, where she could not get out of bed. And I did not know how to handle that. I really didn't know. I'm obviously not a therapist. I'm a journalist. Like, what do I know? So I thought, well, I need to go to therapy to sort of understand what she's going through. And then, you know, she, through her own therapy and medication, felt much better, and I just kept going.
Okay. So,
but then I realized, you know, as I'm sort of digging into therapy, like, there were so many things I needed to talk about and work through that I had never had language for before. I had never had a platform before. I didn't even know I was feeling. So, yeah, I mean, I still, this is what, three therapists ago, I still see her when I go back to that place. Like, I still go and drop in and say hi because it was hugely impactful.
When you look back now with the ASD diagnosis, does ASD answer a lot of the questions you were having that led you into therapy?
Yes and no. I mean, having a frame around the challenges that I've had is really helpful, but it doesn't erase the challenges. It puts a name to it, and it's like, oh, I'm not a bad person. I'm autistic, and that comes with certain challenges. Autism is a disability. It is a neurodevelopmental disability. Whether you choose to call yourself disabled as an autistic person is your choice, but it is a technical disability. And there are ways in which your thinking and your actions can be disabling. So I think just, yeah, the diagnosis alone doesn't wipe out all of the struggles, but it does give language to an issue. And it also helps then the therapist understand, like, if you know, I have an autism competent therapist. That's basically half of her clients are neurodivergent. And so she knows the language and she knows the angle to approach it from. So that's really helpful. But yeah, the diagnosis alone doesn't fix things. I wish.
Yeah. Just like a reveal, like a end of the Sixth Sense kind of, oh, the Bruce Willis was dead all along kind of.
Totally. Totally. Yeah.
Wouldn't that be awesome?
Yeah.
When you got diagnosed as being on the spectrum, did you go out and find a new therapist? Did you drop your old therapist? How did that work?
You know how sometimes we have certain relationships in our lives, friends, romantic partners, you know, whatever, that stay the course and they're with you for your whole life, or they're with you for a period of time. And I felt like my therapist, who I'd been seeing for probably 3 years before my diagnosis, had been very helpful in that period of my life. I learned a lot of things from her about sort of family dynamics and my place in my family and how I grew up and all of that stuff. And then, you know, when I started sort of bringing these questions to her about autism, you know, she did her best, but, you know, every therapist can't know about every need there is out there. They can't know about every condition. And, you know, so she did her best and she tried to refer me to some folks. And this was also during the pandemic. And so we weren't seeing people in person anyway. And therapy kind of just fell off for me because I didn't really enjoy, like, Zoom therapy isn't for me.
Okay.
I'm glad it works for a lot of people, but doesn't work for me. Like, I like to be in a space with somebody. My jokes land better in person.
That's the important thing about therapy is having your jokes land.
Listen, I'm just trying to be good at therapy for my therapist. One of my first therapists told me that I was the most highly motivated, unemployed, slightly depressed person she had ever met and worked
wow.
with. And I was like, oh my God, I'm doing good for my therapist. Like, I felt like I was succeeding for her, you know? So yeah, there's like people pleasing part in the therapy too.
Just subjugate myself and, you know, cover up all the problems I'm having. But if I can please someone else.
Oh, 100%, 100%. I'm like, I'm good at therapy, right? Please validate. But yeah, I ended up, you know, look, finding a therapist who knows anything about autism or neurodivergence is really, really hard.
How did you do it?
Through a lot of poking around, asking people. I mean, luckily my partner has a teenage child who is autistic. And so my partner already had resources. And, you know, she pointed me to these two women who she was friendly with, who I kind of call like my autism fairy godmothers, because they answered every single one of my questions. They're both therapists who work with autistic children, and they answered a ton of questions and pointed me towards therapists who worked with adults, but you know, there are waiting lists and they don't take insurance, or you're out of state, out of network, blah, 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 whatever. I mean, a million problems. I mean, we all know this. There are not enough competent mental health professionals working in this country, and the insurance system makes it even harder for them to get paid well or whatever. Anyway, it's a whole thing. I mean, access to care, we all know, is a joke. So I was lucky to land with my current therapist who had an opening. And I was like, yes, please, I will take it.
So you used some connections and a bunch of research skills to track someone down. And
I did.
And find someone.
Yeah. Yeah. And also tried to be like the most charming. I'm like, maybe like you'll just be like, your schedule isn't open, but like you like me so much. And maybe you want to, you know, but I also was like, I also would say to people, oh, and what do you think about like me recording some of our sessions for this podcast I'm making? And they were like, no, like, what, are you mentally ill? And I was like, yes, I am. Please let me do this. And
that's why I'm coming to you in the first place.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Not that autism is not a mental illness. Let's just be clear. It's a neurodevelopmental disability. But I also have, you know, comorbid mental health challenges in addition to autism.
Right. It's so, also happening at the same time.
It's a combo platter, you know.
When I went to my therapist, I explained to her, well, I actually have a podcast about depression and I'm here to talk to you about depression. And she said, yes, I'm aware of your podcast. I listened to it before you ever contacted me. And I said, yeah. Oh, so this is weird right now, isn't it?
Yeah.
She said, yeah, this is really weird right now.
Right. I mean, that is, I feel like one way that we're a little bit of, you know, a little ahead of the curve is that our therapists can learn a lot about us because we put our work out in public. And so, you know, they can listen to it if they want to. I mean, my old therapist listened to all my shows that had nothing to do with autism whatsoever. And so she would know, like, the work that I was doing. That was very helpful because work is, it's a major part of my, or at the time was a major part of my therapy sort of. It was a thing that I talked about a lot in therapy. So having her know what I was discussing, you know, because she had heard it was good, but also weird.
Right. Right. I slid my book onto my therapist's shelf between all the Brené Brown books, but I don't think she's noticed yet. We'll see. That might come up at a future session.
That's amazing. Like, oh, by the way, you have
a great
bookshelf.
Do you have here? Oh, well, how interesting. Coming up, the difference between therapy for neurodivergent people and neurotypical people. We'll talk to Lauren about that. Then later, we'll talk to a therapist with a lot of experience in helping neurodivergent people.
Hey, let us guess. You love books, but wish you had more time to read.
Or maybe you used to read a lot, but life has gotten in the way, kids, grad school, you name it.
Maybe you don't know where to start, and bookish social media is overwhelming. How do people on TikTok read so many books?
Oh my God, I don't know. And maybe you've been reading the same book for 6 months, and now it's permanently attached to your bedside table.
Maybe you don't even know what you like to read anymore.
We're Reading Glasses, and don't worry, we got you.
We'll get you back into reading and help you enjoy books again.
Reading Glasses, every week on Maximum Fun.
Back with Lauren Ober, journalist, podcast maker, neurodivergent person, therapy goer. So how is neurodivergent talk therapy different from not neurodivergent talk therapy?
Just no eye contact. None.
An interest in trains.
A lot of rocking back and forth. No.
Train schedules that you go over.
Exactly. Exactly. I just talk endlessly about my special interest. No. I don't have a special interest. I wish I did. It would make things so much easier. It would make autism so much easier if I just had a damn special interest. No, I think it's... I think that having somebody who is competent and understands, okay, this is actually how neurodivergent brains work. These are common. If I, you know, I'm saying like I'm having this challenge. I can't figure this out. Or I feel like terrible about X. It's like, oh, actually, that's because your brain works like this and neurotypical brains work like this. And or one thing I've been talking about recently is meltdowns, which, you know, I have a fair number of, or I don't know what a fair number is, but more than I would care to have.
Okay.
And I was explaining the sort of physiology of what I was experiencing to my therapist. I was like, I can't like move. I can't function. I am like sitting like a lump, but I'm hysterically crying, but I can't get off the sofa, but I'm frozen. And she's like, oh, that's called a dorsal vagal reaction. And it's this and blah, blah, blah. And she's like explaining the physiology of it to me. And that is very comforting because I'm like, why can't I just stand up? Like, why can't I just like wipe my tears away and like move along, you know? And she's like, oh, it's because of this and your body shuts down and it's preserving energy and it's blah, 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 whatever. And I just find like when you don't have to explain things to the therapist and they're explaining things to you, that, I mean, that seems like a good bargain to me.
Right. Well,
good use of my money and time, you know, not having to educate, you know, not that every therapist needs to know about autism or any other condition. Like, everybody has a lane, I'm assuming. But having somebody who knows the particularities and, you know, it's not easy because autism is not like a neat set of traits.
Right. It's a spectrum.
It is a spectrum, but it's more like a wheel.
Okay.
In that it's like a giant pie cut up into a lot of weird shapes, and you have a little bit of this and a little bit more of that and some of this. And so rather than a more linear spectrum, it's sort of, I view it as a wheel. Not just me, I didn't create that, a therapist did.
Okay.
A professional created that, but somebody who knows the points in that wheel is really helpful.
So is neurodivergent therapy just a case of the therapist knowing a lot about how your brain works, or is it a completely different approach, or is it a completely different way of doing therapy?
I can't speak for all, you know, autistic people who are in therapy or different modalities of therapy that autistic people and neurodivergent people use.
Yeah.
For me, it's just basic talk therapy rooted in an understanding of how autistic brains are wired. Mm. So, you know, we're not doing like CBT or, you know, other sort of specific types of therapy. I mean, I go to a licensed clinical social worker. I don't go to a neuropsychologist or something like that. I mean, I think for children who are neurodivergent, and they are working on life skills. They're working on, you know, executive functioning. They're working on emotional regulation and dysregulation. It's almost a more practical application. And you know, I've gotten to a point where, like, I'm 44. I'm a, you know, relatively a professional person. Like, I work and I manage my life. Okay. And so I figured out for the most part those things that like a neuropsychologist would be working on with a child, but I need to do a lot of processing what it is to be undiagnosed for 44 years, basically, and the damage that has done.
Is that more the issue that you spent all those years undiagnosed and you're dealing with the fallout from that?
That's a lot of it. Yeah. I think that I was a loud, rowdy kid. I didn't make friends easily. I had a lot of social challenges. And the answers that you have when you're younger are like, oh, it's my fault. I'm bad. I'm this. I'm that. It's like, it's all me. It's I can't do it right. I'm deficient. So you're basically trying to untangle all of these bad feelings from the past, but then also how are you living presently and what are the challenges now? I mean, look, like there was a huge mental health fallout from doing a whole show about my diagnosis. Like, it was very, it was cathartic, and it was extremely helpful for a lot of people, at least so I've heard from a lot of listeners. But then, you know, it took a huge emotional toll. And so then I'm dealing with that with my therapist, but then also sort of family of origin stuff and childhood trauma. And I talk a lot about, you know, in the show, the ways that I was treated by teachers. So yeah, you gotta unpack all of that stuff. I mean, I had one therapist who explained therapy to me like, you have this giant ball of string that's all knotted up. And therapy, like, it's a huge string, lots of strands, or it's a huge ball with lots of strands. And therapy is a process of unknotting that ball to where all the strands can lie flat. However, in the process of unknotting these over here that you've already unknotted get knotted up. And so it isn't linear, and you're jumping back in time, and then you're in the present, and you're doing all, you know. And I think for me personally, I now have a whole new set of questions, I guess, to unpack, because it's like now I have this new frame or this new lens to see my life through.
That's Lauren Ober. Her podcast is The Loudest Girl in the World. Just ahead, a look at therapy for people on the autism spectrum with a therapist on the autism spectrum.
What happens when you give a bug recreational drugs?
What was the first recorded sound?
How do we figure out how old the Earth is?
Let's find out together on our show, Let's Learn Everything, where we learn anything and everything interesting.
My name's Caroline, and I studied biodiversity and conservation.
My name's Tom, and I studied computer science and cognitive blah, 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 blah.
Did you?
And my name's Ella, and I studied stem cells and regenerative medicine.
On our show, we do as much research as you would for a class, but we don't get in trouble for making each other laugh.
And we get to say f***.
Maybe not in the trailer.
Subscribe to Let's Learn Everything every other Thursday on Maximum Fun.
Finn Grattan is a psychotherapist, trainer, and consultant in Santa Cruz, California. They practice somatic therapy, and they say on their website, quote, "Somatic therapy attends to the connection between thoughts, feelings, and physical acts and sensations, and integrates this with verbal strategies," unquote. Finn mentions masking in this interview, and just so you know, that doesn't mean like COVID masks. It means someone with autism trying to behave in a neurotypical way. Finn Grattan, welcome to Depression Mode.
Thanks, John. It's good to be here.
You serve a wide variety of clients, obviously, in your practice. How is therapy for someone on the spectrum different from therapy for someone who isn't?
I think I'll start, John, with I'm autistic.
Okay.
So they're having therapy with an autistic clinician, so I'm better meeting them because I don't expect them to communicate or experience things in a non-autistic way. And non-autistic clinicians can also have that way with clients, but people who haven't really taken in the range of experiences people can be having, the amount of masking they need to do to be in the world, and just the ways that those sensory and differences in processing affect communication, as well as a history of bad experiences, will affect your communication. So for me, it's easier being with a neurodivergent client, not just because I'm autistic, but because there's a capacity to connect in different ways other than just idiom rich, but expectation about what language and what nonverbals mean. So it opens up to, I think, an easier way to get into actually doing therapeutic work.
I imagine it's more efficient also in a way if the therapist and the client aren't having to kind of figure out who each other are quite as much in order to get to some more of the real substantive work.
I guess efficient's a good word, good enough word for it. You're not having to use up a lot of time trying to find make a therapeutic alliance. That said, I have many clients whose neurodivergent is quite different from mine. And we will, some with pretty poor expressive language and while good, you know, receptive language, and we will just bounce along and work at it. But the difference is that it's I hold it as very collaborative, and not that they're having a problem communicating with me. We're having a problem establishing communication works for both of us.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, since autism is a spectrum and definitionally very, very wide, very diverse. How do you tailor therapy to the individual? Like, how do you assess where they are, where you are, and kind of find a place where you can connect?
So I think therapy, like, it costs so much as you're doing one-on-one with somebody. And kind of the first and biggest thing you do is finding that connection. And I think it's the biggest mistake that some therapists will do is they'll think they need to be doing a technique before they've ever established any connection. I'm a somatic therapist, so my sense, I'm attending, whether I'm doing some somatic thing, I'm attending for my body and listening very much and settling my own body and listening to what's going on for them. And we will find a connection energetically first. We may laugh around with words or do things. Some autistic people are extremely, vocabulary and words are very important to them because people often misread their nonverbal because they have a high verbal ability. And so they'll use a lot of words. And so I really turn on the brain part of my body to like join with that joy of words and the meaning of words with them. But it doesn't mean I shut off my heart too. It's just that is a big joining other people. There's a joining around just finding a way to settle together after they had to get through the world to get to my office. If they do that, we do a lot of Zoom work, but I also do office work.
Hmm. You mentioned the idea of masking and of trying to fit into the world, trying to fit into a world that sometimes works differently than is optimal for somebody on the spectrum. Is that a big issue in why some of these people are seeking therapy, just this kind of dissonance that they're running across?
The one level answer is yes, of course. So, and I want to go back before that and say, masking is both unconscious, like 90-something, like most of masking is unconscious. We naturally kind of adapt and shift to kind of try to not get hurt emotionally, physically, something. Some people have greater capacity to mask. Some don't. Their experiences, their reactions are so intense that they can't so well. So they're in greater danger. Because of that, that doesn't mean they still aren't masking a lot. They're just more is coming through. A lot of people talk about unmasking, but unmasking is really a privilege. It is not safe to unmask in a lot of situations for everybody. But if you're BIPOC, if you're... or have a marginalized identity, if you have a job that's not going to drop you, that's not going to make accommodations, then it's not safe to unmask. And so that was the first preamble to, yes, masking causes a lot of distress in our bodies and minds. It's hard to keep track of like who you are and what you want when a lot of your system is in a stress response. It's really a fawning response to mask. Fawning is like being in a fight and flight, but also a freeze. You have to mask to survive. You don't even know you're doing this. And what you present gets distant from who you might have been or who you are without the masking. And for a lot of people, it's kind of might have been. And once they realize that they are autistic, there's a lot of backing up and going, oh, you know, I have this self that really didn't get to be. And some of the people around me really don't want to be with that person that is my more unmasked, relaxed, better in my body self. Do I make new friends, partners, relationships? You know, what do I do with my life now? And there's a lot of grieving over how much effort from a very young age that has gone into just making yourself safe enough.
So then does the therapy go to kind of building an awareness of how the masking works, how society works, how somebody works within society? Because you're not gonna change the world, unfortunately. You're not gonna change discrimination and biases entirely. So is it a matter of building an awareness and a consciousness within the client?
Well, it depends on where people are at. Some people, they're seeing me for some other needs. They need their masking. There may be an awareness that they're doing it. So like what you said is true. It's helpful to know that you're doing it sometimes. Oftentimes that makes people rather angry and sad. I work with a lot of trans folks. There's kind of a concern that if they actually reveal their autism, that they'll have trouble getting because of their, you know, what their parents might think, what everybody might, other adults, if they're adults, might think, what the medical people might think. And so they'll mask it to get their gender care. We can make them aware that you're masking, and they may already be aware of that. But if they're at a place and a safety enough so that they can start to unmask some, then we will do that. And usually people already have ways of doing that. They already have ways that when they're safe, they're with their music, there's something that autistic people's stimming is a response and connection with the environment often, and with their bodies, with movement. So we'll start trying to reclaim some of that and free up some of the intense holding in.
You know, I know from talking to a number of therapists that in an intake session, there's often a discussion of what is the client's goals for therapy? What are they hoping to achieve through therapy? Are there goals that are unique to people on the spectrum that you don't hear so much from people who aren't on the spectrum? What is often asked for among people who are?
I don't think the goals are really different than the people I see who aren't. I want ease from some anxiety, to be less depressed, to have better connection and relationships with others. There's the difference in that. The reason why they might be having trouble in, you know, with relationships is because of the double empathy problem, with how a lot of non-autistic people don't have an understanding of, you know, have a hard time really sensing that there is a, that they need to do some work too in meeting that cultural communication challenge. But I don't see a difference, except for people, they want to understand. They want to understand how autism has affected their lives, and that's different. You know, we'll spend a while unpacking and sharing a lot of information about how autism affects people in different ways, their sensory stuff, the cognitive bottom-up processing and all that, and how that affects communication, the literalness of how important it is to get exactly what you mean. So that's something that's different, and I guess could be a major goal, is just help me understand myself and the world, because the world hasn't really helped me understand myself. It's kind of taken me further and further away from myself and hasn't really helped me understand the world very well. Like, why do people do that? So we do spend a while going, why do people say things they don't mean? Why are people mean to people as a way of building a social group? Why do they do that? What does it do for people who are non-autistic to do kind of teasing, mean, put down things? What is that about?
Yeah. We spoke with Lauren Ober, who's a podcast maker for this program as well. And she was diagnosed and tested and diagnosed later in life, in her 40s. And for her, she sort of sensed that there was something going on, but until she tested and got a pronouncement, a diagnosis, that's when things seemed real and everything seemed to shift for her. How important do you think it is for someone to be tested and be diagnosed? Like, if someone is wondering about this kind of thing, do you recommend that they get tested and diagnosed?
No, I usually talk about, I mean, I don't just straight out recommend it. I talk about the pros and cons of it. We discuss and explore what that would mean for them. So there are some pros, and that there's some very specific testing that some of my clients will get that will help them understand things. Like if they understand that their verbal skills are in the top 5 or 10% and their processing speed is in the bottom 5 or 10%, then we can start picking apart why they thought they were dumb when they really weren't, or why they thought they were smart but not performing, why people said that. We'll have that thing. Or we'll learn something about their memory, that they're like certain kinds of memory work well and others don't. But that's pretty intense, thorough testing. That's not a series of screens and tests. That's more. And I find that very helpful. Two, it's helpful if they need it for disability or for accommodations or something like that. Others don't want it because it's going to show up in their medical record and they know that there's medical bias and they could get into certain kind of jobs and they don't want that bias, so they're not going to have that. They might not want it because there are not very many people who do assessment in the country percentage-wise who come from a neurodiversity-affirming place, who understand presentation by high masking people, and who think. And I've had a number of people come to me and had their assessor just kind of look at them and talk with them and say, no, you're not autistic because you can kind of make eye contact. Like, I'm not making eye contact with you, even though I'm looking maybe like I am sometimes. And that they have conversation that you and I are having. Then that would seem like they're not autistic to this person who doesn't even do a bunch of the tests said, well, I am a clinical expert on autism and you don't have it. Therefore, really, really further disturbing a person who is already feeling like there's something going on. I have a lot of signs for myself and other people. And this expert has said there isn't. So now I'm just what they've always thought. I'm just basically damaged. And so some really horrible things have happened for people who go and are not recognized. Now, I'm going to put a little caveat for that. There are people who recognize they're neurodivergent. Autism seems to make sense. They have an easier time communicating with other autistic people. And actually, a thorough assessment, some really thoughtful neurodiversity-affirming assessment might say, actually, it's looking a lot like ADHD, some high verbal skills, a lot of trauma, but it's not ticking enough autistic boxes to say it's really that. But if you feel good in the autistic community, hang with the autistic community, we're not going to kick people out. Autistic community, we don't say, oh, do you have your like little
have your card
from the doctor? You know, like, no
way. Are you board
way.
Certified to be autistic?
And we're asking an expert other than us to know ourselves. And we never do that. My other work is gender. We never do that around gender. How do you know you're non-binary or trans or something? Well, I know, you know, and I have this history of things, and we may go through the history of like experiences and feelings, and we're like, yeah, sounds like you have gender dysphoria, sounds like, because you, it sounds, you know, and you are who you are. But we haven't really allowed, we being medical establishment, haven't allowed that for autistic people to just say, I'm this. And we've also boxed it into these boxes and say, well, you don't quite meet those criteria. And if somebody doesn't quite meet something, even though they have quite a bit of neurodivergence in ways and they need neurodivergent community, well, if the medical box doesn't exist for them, then they don't have a place to go within that world and they don't feel validated. So I've had people get diagnoses and they get really validated, like, yay, I could, you know, yay, and oh my God, what does this mean? But now it's real. And other people like, medical isn't real to me. Just because a medical person said that, I'm going to take my sense of whether I'm real and give it to this medical expert and let them tell me whether my experience is real. That's a problem we're going to have as long as we have this category that's called autism, that is a collection of characteristics, and that we put it in that big old book that's the DSM or the ICD-10. rather than recognize that neurodivergence is always here. And what the inlier is some kind of neuronormative experience that people get further and further from.
There's a term in the DSM, Diagnostic and Statistic Manual, of autism spectrum disorder. Do you believe it's a disorder, and do you use that term?
I do not use the term. It's not a disorder. It's not a mental illness.
Is there a thing you would describe it as opposed to a disorder or a mental illness? A shorthand term?
It's a way of being human.
Okay, great.
It's a highly stigmatized, at this point in time, a challenging way and place, a challenging way of being a human.
Yeah.
I don't think humans would be where they are without a long history of what is now called autistic people or ADHD folks. But that's kind of elitism in a way, like we matter, you know, because it doesn't matter. You know, whatever way you are different on this planet, you are a human and you're valuable and you're not disordered. So that's my answer.
That's a wonderful answer. Finn Grattan, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Good to talk with you, John.
Finn Grattan, a psychotherapist, trainer, and consultant based in Santa Cruz. Next time on Depression Mode, lead guitarists are confident and full of swagger, arrogant even. Well, yeah, not all the time.
Death Cab for Cutie is still and will forever be the work of my adult life. I love that time and I love those records and I'm really proud of them. To walk away from the group of people who did that, like I walked away from a really massive piece of my personal identity. It's been a real struggle and it's been a real challenge to find a way to claim ownership and pride in the creative work, in the albums and in the songs, even as I'm not a part of the group anymore. And even though the group is an active group that's on a path that's, you know, parallel to mine.
Chris Walla, formerly of the band Death Cab for Cutie, joins us. Hey, as long as I got you here, we want to try to book you as a guest on Depression Mode. We're putting together a special called What Works for Me, and we want to hear what works for your mental health. What improves your overall mental well-being? What strengthens it? What is something that might not solve all of everybody's problems, but just helps you get through the day? Unconventional answers are very welcome. And again, we don't need something that can help everybody. We just want to know what works for you. Record your answer on your phone's voice memo app. Make it no longer than a minute. Include your name and where you live, and then email that file to depressionmode@maximumfun.org. We may use your answer on the show. Our merchandise shop is open. It's at maxfunstore.com. You can shop for all sorts of Depression Mode goodies, many of which feature the slogan, "I'm glad you're here," which is something I say on every show, which is something that I mean. We've got t-shirts, we've got beanies, we've got sweatpants, we've got all sorts of things. Check it out, maxfunstore.com. Find Depression Mode and you'll be off to the races and you'll be supporting the show. Speaking of supporting the show, if people support our show through our merchandise shop or through donations, they are helping this show exist. If people keep doing that, the show exists. If people don't donate to the show, if people don't support it, it goes away. We don't want it to go away. We love making the show for you and we think it's helping people. So to become a member of Depression Mode, to be a donor of Depression Mode and enjoy the satisfaction that goes with that, just go to MaximumFun.org/join in order to donate. Be sure to hit subscribe, give us 5 stars, write rave reviews. All of that helps get the word out about the show so more people can hear it and more people can be helped. The Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is available in the United States by calling 988, the crisis text line, also free, always available. Text the word HOME to 741741. Our electric mail address is depressionmode@maximumfun.org. If you're on Facebook, look up our mental health discussion group, Preshies. We're on Instagram at DepreshPod, and our Depression Mode newsletter is on Substack. Search that up. I'm on Twitter at John Moe. And Instagram at John Moe. Hi, credits listeners. Something no one points out to you when you're a kid is that when you become an adult, you have to clean the kitchen every day for as long as you live. It's probably good we don't tell kids this, because their little spirits would break. Depression Mode is made possible by contributions from you. The show is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson, and we get booking help from Mara Davis. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings. Thanks this week to Jesse Thorne.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out, building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason, maybe there's no reason, I just keep believing. No one knows the answer, maybe there's no answer, I just keep on dancing.
Hi, this is Mary Beth from Austin, Texas, and we're laughing and listening together.
Depression Mode is a production of Maximum Fun and Papa Chick. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.